Thank you to the musicians for leading us in the worship of God. Thanks to Jesus for making possible the worship of God. Now let's continue to worship God in the Word. 2 Samuel 15, page 266. If you need to use the Bible from the back of the seat that's in front of you, I hope you'll open up there. We're going to cover a lot of ground, chapters 15, 16, and 17 this morning. Christian singing and Christian living are sometimes vastly different, aren't they? I don't know how you feel about the songs that we just sang, how you interact with those lyrics, but sometimes we say things that are far removed from our own experience. And that's okay. We want to sing better than we sometimes believe or feel, but you know, like, a mighty fortress is our God, a bulwark, never failing. And then we find ourselves in circumstances where we feel anything but safe and secure in a fortress. Or we sing, his kingdom cannot fail, he rules o'er earth and heaven. The keys of death and hell are to our Jesus given. And then we look around and it seems like hell is advancing at breakneck pace in our society and around the world. The promise of God's kingdom and our experience of his kingdom are sometimes vastly different, aren't they? And the songs aren't wrong. Jesus himself said when he came, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And then he proved it by forgiving sins and healing the sick and freeing captives and welcoming outcasts, doing all the things that happen when God reigns in our hearts and in our lives and in our world. But then our own experience of living under Jesus' rule doesn't seem to deliver those same benefits. Can you relate to that? What should we do about that experience between a kingdom proclaimed and come and an experience that doesn't feel like the right guy is in charge? Well, what we should do with that is we should turn to 2 Samuel 15. Because there we see David struggling with that exact same experience just a few decades earlier. In our account, it's just a few chapters earlier, chapter 7. David heard a promise from God that he would receive a kingdom that would never fail, that one of his sons would always be on the throne, that God would remember him and give him a great name forever. But here in chapter 15, he finds himself running for his life. What do you do when that happens? Well, you remember this. God is still in control even when his kingdom is under attack. That's the lesson in these three chapters for us this morning. It's a truth the narrator wants to press home to his original readers and us these thousands of years later. And it's a reminder that we need frequently, don't we? God is still in control, even when his rule of goodness and love in our lives seems to be under attack. Let's take a look at it, chapter 15, verse 1. I'm not going to reread what James read for us, 1 through 17, but I'll just review that. Things start to go sideways right away, don't they? Absalom, David's oldest surviving son and heir to the throne, holds a press conference, and he announces, this country needs a change, and I'm the one to bring it. Basically what happens. That's not quite how the text reads, but that's the point. All right, he gets a chariot and a posse, makes himself look like a king. Verse 1. Verse 2, he starts hanging out where the people will see him. Verse 4, he starts smearing his opponent and making splashy promises of what he'll do when he's in charge. I mean, it's right here on these pages in front of you. He gets an appearance on The Tonight Show. That's verse 5. He pretends like he's a man of the people instead of a lifelong politician born to privilege. When has that ever happened, right? I mean, just hearing about it gets you all excited for the next election cycle that's right around the corner. I'm sorry if you thought you were safe from all of that in church. Here's what you need to know. The charm of our political process goes back 3,000 years. None of this is new. All this crazy mayhem is right here in 1 Samuel 15. But Absalom is a really shrewd operator. His question in verse 2, is calculated to prey on old suspicions and divisions within the kingdom. Notice how he says it. From what city are you? And if the person would answer, I'm from such and such a tribe in Israel, he would say, oh, there's not anybody here that will hear your case. Remember, wink, wink, our king is actually from Judah. So he's preying upon these divisions that already exist in the land, this restlessness. And if the person would answer, I'm from a tribe in Israel, he would bemoan the lack of justice and suggest that if he were in charge, things would be so much better. As though David were unjust. The narrator has told us the exact opposite, hasn't he? And the narrator, inspired by the Holy Spirit, is always right. The narrator told us in chapter 8, David administered justice and equity to all his people. And there wasn't a lack of access to the king, right? We just read a couple of chapters ago how Joab sent a woman before the king, and she got there, and she expressed her case pleading for justice, and he promised her a decision. Absalom's lying. But he's good at it. Verse 6 sums up for us that so he stole the hearts of all the men of Israel. Verse 7 tells us after campaigning 4 years like this, he was ready. He holds a pretend worship service, verses 7 and 8, in Hebron. Hebron's about 18 miles from Jerusalem, far enough away to be safe, close enough to get important people there. It's the city where Absalom was born. It's the city where David was crowned king a few decades earlier. He sends allies through the land to act as plants in his magic show that he's about to pull off. Verse 11, he gets some prominent guests, ignorant guests, 200 of them, but prominent guests from Israelite society. It's all a facade. He doesn't have the support he needs, but he wants to make it look like he does. But in verse 12, he scores a real point. Look at verse 12. He gets David's old advisor Ahithophel on his side. And the narrator sums up the action for us, end of verse 12. The conspiracy grew strong, and the people with Absalom kept increasing. Verse 13, news of Absalom's coup quickly reaches David, who immediately gathers his family, packs his bags, and leaves town. Why? He knows Absalom is ruthless. This is a guy that burned down Joab's fields just to talk with him. He's killed his brother Amnon. He'll stop at nothing. And David knows if he stays in Jerusalem, that city could be besieged by Absalom and his men, and all the people could suffer. He's not willing to risk that, verse 14. So he leaves 10 of his concubines in charge of the household and leaves Jerusalem. Now notice what happens at this point in the story. The narrator has taken 17 verses, really just 6 verses, but 17 verses to set up for David leaving the city of Jerusalem. Now he takes most of the next 3 chapters to tell us that story. That's the point. David's departure is the point. He wants to talk to us about who David meets along the way and what he says and how he handles himself. Why? Because this is not a Hollywood movie. If this were a Hollywood movie, we would see the real action, right? The gunfights, the car chases, right? The epic battle, the close call. No. This narrator wants us to watch how the king handles people when he's under stress, what he thinks and feels about what's happening to him, and most importantly, what he believes about his God. And it's a good example for us. We want to watch as the king handles his whole world crumbling to dust all around him. I don't know what you bring to this moment this morning. Some of you I know, but not every story in the room. But I wonder if you connect to that. This isn't just a king in charge of a kingdom fleeing a son who's threatening his life. That hasn't happened to any of us this week. But our world crumbling to dust? Yeah, that's right where some of you are. David meets 6 people on his journey out of town. The first one is a warrior, verse 18. All his servants passed by him, and all the Cherethites and the Pelethites and 600 Gittites who had followed him from Gath passed on before the king. And the king said to Ittai, the Gittite, "Why do you also go with us? Go back and stay with the king. For you're a foreigner and also an exile from your home. You came only yesterday. Shall I today make you wander about with us since I go I know not where? Go back and take your brothers with you, and may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you. But Ittai answered the king, as the Lord lives, and as my Lord the king lives. Notice Ittai is quick to correct David. David says, go live with the king, referring to Absalom. Ittai says, I'm already with him. As the Lord lives and as my Lord the king lives, wherever my Lord the king shall be, whether for death or for life, there also will your servant be. And David said to Ittai, go then, pass on. So Ittai the Gittite passed on with all his men and all the little ones who were with him. He even stakes his family on David. Verse 23, and all the land wept aloud as all the people passed by, and the king crossed the brook Kidron, and all the people passed on toward the wilderness. These warrior bands in verse 18, these people groups, the Cherethites, Pelethites, Gittites, these are all David's bodyguard. These are warriors. These are hundreds of men trained for and experienced in war. Sure, none of them are Israelites. I mean, Ittai himself is a Philistine. That's what Gittite means, from the town of Gath. So David's got Philistines that are loyal to him. And at a time like this, he'll take whatever loyal supporters he can get. And these are some good ones. Did you hear an echo in Ittai's words of anyone else in the Bible who pledges against all odds to stay with someone who can offer them nothing? It sounds a lot like Ruth, doesn't it? I mean, look at his words. It sounds like, your God will be my God. Where you go, I will go. Where you die, I will die. It sounds a good deal like that, doesn't it? That's intentional. And as we go through this, be alert for more callbacks, little echoes of Israel's prior story that you'll see throughout this narrative. There are several of them in this chapter, but at this point, here's one thing that's clear. Absalom's support may be growing, but David has the better, more loyal army, and that's important. Verse 24, he also has the support of the priests. Here's his second meeting. Abiathar came up, and Zadok came also with all the Levites bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God, and they set down the Ark of God until the people had passed out of the city. Then the king said to Zadok, carry the Ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and let me see both it and his dwelling place. But if he says, I have no pleasure in you, behold, here I am. Let him do to me what seems good to him. The king also said to Zadok the priest, are you not a seer? In other words, you'll have access. They'll let you in. Go back to the city in peace with your two sons, Ahimaaz, your son, and Jonathan, the son of Abiathar. See, I'll wait at the fords of the wilderness till word comes from you to inform me. So Zadok and Abiathar carried the Ark of God back to Jerusalem, and they remained there. So now the narrator has us, he's moving us geographically along. Don't miss those markers. David and his company have crossed the brook Kidron, right outside Jerusalem. And the Levites show up, bringing the ark with them, and we are introduced to four characters. There's four key names. They'll show up later in the story. Abiathar and Zadok, the main priests, and their sons, Ahimaaz and Jonathan. And David makes two key decisions with these guys. First, he sends the ark back. That's exactly the right decision, isn't it? David had learned the lesson from decades earlier when Israel brought the ark with them to war, trying to manipulate God into helping them. Back in the days of Eli, 1 Samuel chapter 4, he's not going to do that. In fact, David knows now that Jerusalem is the place on planet Earth where Yahweh has chosen to dwell. And instead of trying to take the ark and Yahweh with him, he surrenders himself consciously to God's will. Look at how he says it. If I have found favor in the eyes of the Lord, he'll bring me back. Friends, lest you think David is just weakly abdicating his throne, there's not weakness here at all. This is a full, ferocious, self-conscious surrender to God. Fully surrendered is fully trusting. That's what David's doing, trusting God. The second thing he does with these guys, verses 27 to 29, he asks the priests to function as his eyes and ears inside the new administration. These are seers. These are prophets. They'll have access. They'll be welcomed in. And that becomes a key point in the plot to follow. He asks them, bring me word on Absalom's movements. Third, someone else comes to David with more news, verse 30. David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went, barefoot, with his head covered. And all the people who were with him covered their heads, and they went up, weeping as they went. And it was told David, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, oh Lord, please turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. Now, I set this paragraph up by saying a third person comes to David. It's a messenger. But don't miss the sorrow. The narrator has focused on that twice now. Verse 23, and the land wept aloud. And now verse 30, David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives weeping. We learn more about David's inner life in these three chapters than anywhere else in the rest of Samuel's story. There's more in the Psalms, but this isn't the Psalms. We just have the narration of David, the king, and we learn so much about his emotions and his attitude toward God. And isn't this a comfort? It is to me. To see this stud of a man, this warrior, this strong guy that any kind of manly man will follow, to see him weeping in this moment. He's heartbroken. He's crushed. I've been there. But notice this too. His tears are not a sign of lack of faith. He's weeping and trusting God. Don't make that mistake when you counsel friends who are going through hardship or when you go through it yourself. You know, this is how it goes sometimes. Hey, I just went and saw, you know, Susie. Oh, how is she doing? Oh, she's doing really great, by which we mean she's not even crying anymore. Or if she is crying, we say she's still having a really hard time. Well, of course she's having a hard time. The question is, how's her faith? Weeping is not a problem for God. It's not a problem for Christians. It shouldn't be a problem for you. Weep when your heart's broken and trust. Let your friends weep when their heart is broken and tell them they can trust. So I don't want to brush past the emotion. But there's a thing here the narrator wants to tell us. Verse 31, David first hears that Ahithophel is on Absalom's side, and that is bad news. In chapter 16, we learn why. Verse 23 tells us that in David and Absalom's eyes, the counsel of Ahithophel was like the words of God himself. David's concerned about Ahithophel. But look at what he does. Instead of despairing over this news about Ahithophel, what does he do? He immediately turns it into prayer. You see that? Verse 31. David hears this dread report and immediately talks to God. Friends, oh, if we could only learn this lesson. Instead of talking to yourself about how horrible the news is that you just heard, explain to God why he needs to get involved. Turn it into prayer. That's what David does. Fourth, he encounters an old friend, verse 32. While David was coming to the summit where God was worshiped, do you notice the narrator slowly moving us through the geography? That matters. We'll come back to that. Behold, Hushai the Archite came to meet him with his coat torn and dirt on his head. And David said to him, if you go on with me, you'll be a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I'll be your servant, O king, as I have been your father's servant in times past, so now I will be your servant, then you will defeat for me the counsel of Ahithophel. And are not Zadok and Abiathar the priests with you there? So whatever you hear from the king's house, tell it to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. Behold, their two sons are with them, Ahimaaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son. And by them, you can send to me everything you hear. So Hushai, David's friend, came to the city just as Absalom was entering Jerusalem. Here's an immediate answer to David's prayer. God, please turn Ahithophel's counsel to madness. And here comes another counselor. And David sends him, gives him advice, says, please, whatever Ahithophel says, counter that. And then send word to me through the priests. So now David has a couple of assets in Absalom's new administration, doesn't he? These priests and this advisor. But before we see what happens back at the ranch, in chapter 16, we meet a fifth individual along the way. This guy is an imposter. When David had passed a little beyond the summit, chapter 16, verse 1, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him with a couple donkeys saddled, bearing 200 loaves of bread, 100 bunches of raisins, 100 summer fruits, and a skin of wine. There's actually a mild textual problem here. It's the number of donkeys. There might have been more of them, and there probably were, to carry that kind of load. This is great. Thanks for the provisions. Verse 2, the king said to Ziba, why have you brought these? And Ziba answered, the donkeys are for the king's household to ride, the bread and summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine for those who faint in the wilderness to drink. Oh, great. Now, we've met Ziba before. If you weren't here with us, Ziba is a servant of Saul's household who David used to find the one remaining son of Jonathan, Mephibosheth. And in that exchange, David put Ziba under Mephibosheth's authority and said, take care of Jonathan's son. And from that point forward, it appears he did. He was a little bit of a sketchy character back when that happened, but here, this is full on Sketchville. Verse 3, the king says, where's your master's son? And Ziba said, he remains in Jerusalem, for he said, today the house of Israel will give me back the kingdom of my father. That doesn't even pass the straight face test, does it? Absalom, the son of David, is taking the throne for whom? Mephibosheth? Why? Saul's family? No, he's taking it for himself. It's obvious to anyone that that's not actually what's going on. Ziba's totally lying. He's playing both sides. If David's kingdom regains its throne, hey, he's been a friend to David. If Absalom's, you notice, Ziba doesn't go with David. He goes back to Jerusalem. But David, in the heat of the moment, doesn't see through all of that, and he's hardly to be blamed. We don't make our best decisions when we're emotional. Verse 4, the king said to Ziba, behold, all that belonged to Mephibosheth is yours. Now, he'll straighten this decision out later, but Ziba, for his part, takes it. I pay homage. Let me find favor in your sight, my lord the king. This guy's here to play both sides. Spins out a lie about Mephibosheth to get it done. So David has met a warrior and the priests and a messenger and a friend and an imposter, and now he meets a full-on enemy, verse 5, chapter 16. When David came to Bahurim, there came out a man of the family of the house of Saul whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera, and as he came, he cursed continually. He threw stones at David and all the servants of David and all the people and the mighty men who were on his right hand and on his left. One thing you got to admit, this guy's got some guts. He's throwing stones at warriors. Verse 7, and Shimei said as he cursed, get out, you man of blood, you worthless man. Yahweh has avenged on you all the blood of the house of Saul in whose place you reigned. And the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. See, your evil is on you, for you are a man of blood. And Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and take off his head. This is one of the reasons I love the book of Samuel. This is just, these guys are warriors. Now, the problem with Joab and Abishai, his brother, these sons of Zeruiah, they totally are on board with David's program. They just don't know anything about David's God. They just have no restraint. And most of the time they make a reckless, bad decision that hurts David. Well, in this case, David says, verse 11, said to Abishai and all his servants, verse 10, the king said, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? If he's cursing because the Lord said to him, curse David, who shall say, why have you done so? So Abishai steps back, and then David says to Abishai and all his servants, behold, my own son seeks my life. How much more may this Benjamite? Leave him alone. Let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. It may be that the Lord will look on the wrong done to me, and the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing today. So David and his men went on the road while Shimei went along on the hillside opposite and cursed as he went and threw stones and flung dust. And the king and all the people who were with him arrived weary at the Jordan. And there he refreshed himself. There's mercy. Well, you can understand what happens here. This descendant of Saul charges David with Saul's blood. Not true. But he also charges him with bringing on himself what's happening with Absalom. That actually is true, isn't it? Why do I say that David brought this on himself? Because that's David's view. You saw it. I slowed down a little bit in verse 11, but look at it again. Because we need to see how the king handles a situation like this when his world is melting down around him. Verse 11, my own son seeks my life, how much more this Benjamite? Leave him alone, let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. It may be that the Lord will look on the wrong done to me. Now that's a textual problem. It's hard to translate because there are three Hebrew words that look very similar and they all mean things that make sense here. One of them could be the affliction that I'm suffering. And that's how some versions translate it. One of them could be the wrong. And the translational difficulty is it the wrong that David says he's done or the wrong that Shimei's doing to him? And then the third way could be the Lord look on my eyes, meaning my eyes full of tears. So is David saying maybe the Lord will look on the hardship I'm suffering? Or is David saying maybe the Lord will look on the iniquity that I've committed? Instead of the wrong done to me, it's actually, I think, the wrong that I've done. I think that's actually, the oldest Hebrew manuscripts say that, and it's easy for me to understand how a translator, or not a translator, but a scribe would change it to the affliction I'm suffering from the iniquity I've committed, but it's hard for me to see how he'd change it the other way around. We can talk more about that if you have questions, but here's the point. David doesn't shy away from the fact that this is the result of his own sins. Nathan said so. Didn't he? Nathan said to him, there will be suffering that comes on you from your own house. We'll look at it in more detail in a moment. David is acknowledging that his own sins against Bathsheba and Uriah set this whole foul plan in motion. And how does he plead on that basis? He doesn't say, I deserve to be cursed, therefore everyone including God has abandoned me. He says, I deserve to be cursed, but God might have mercy on me. Right? Notice that. It may be the Lord will look on the wrong I've done and the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing. In other words, David knows his God has steadfast love and mercy on those who sin. His revelation to Moses on the mountain, he declared his name and said, I am the Lord who forgives iniquity and transgression and sin. David's pleading on that basis. And here's why I stress this, because there are some times that our world melts down around us and it's our own fault. We've done it. There are other times that we're victims of circumstance. Our health goes sideways or our kid does something or our boss. But there are times that we lose our health because of our own bad decisions when we were young. Or we lose our kid because of horrible parenting. Or we find ourselves with no good options because the law is coming against us for our own crimes. Friends, even in those situations, you have a God who will help you. He forgives sins. That's David's plea. And now finally, the scene shifts back to the palace. You can almost see the narrator in verse 15. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel with him. And when Hushai the Archite, David's friend, came to Absalom, Hushai said to Absalom, long live the king, long live the king. Absalom said, is this your loyalty to your friend? Why did you not go with your friend? And Hushai said to Absalom, no, for whom the Lord and this people and all the men of Israel have chosen, his I will be, with him I will remain. And again, whom should I serve? Should it not be his son? As I've served your father, so I will serve you. Notice Hushai doesn't quite come out and say, I'm Absalom's man. Everything he says could be heard two ways. If you're Absalom, self-important and in charge in this moment, you're going to hear Hushai saying, long live the king, long live you, Absalom. But what Hushai really means is, long live David. That's his loyalty, isn't it? Long live the real king. Verse 18, he doesn't declare loyalty to Absalom, he declares loyalty to whomever the Lord and the people have supported. Well, David is the Lord's king, not Absalom. Even in verse 19, in light of his loyalty to the Lord's king, his comments in verse 19 aren't quite what Absalom would have heard. He's pledging to serve Absalom the same way he served David, namely with loyalty to the Lord and Yahweh's man. So Hushai, and for whatever reason, Absalom's like, oh man, so glad to have you here, bro. And Hushai's like, yeah, all right, that worked. Verse 20, Absalom immediately seeks Ahithophel's advice and receives two recommendations. The first one is the end of chapter 16 here. Absalom said to Ahithophel, give your counsel, what shall we do? Here's a guy who worked a long time to be in this spot, and now he has no idea what's his next step. But he gets a good recommendation from Ahithophel in terms of the politics. It's a gross suggestion on its face, but the political reason for it seems to make sense. Ahithophel said to Absalom, go into your father's concubines, whom he's left in the house. All Israel will hear you've made yourself a stench to your father, and the hands of those with you will be strengthened. So he did. They pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof, and Absalom went into his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. Now, in those days, the counsel Ahithophel gave was as if one consulted the word of God. So was all the counsel of Ahithophel esteemed by David and Absalom. Do you remember Nathan's warning in chapter 12? He said to David, thus says the Lord, I will raise up evil against you out of your own house. I will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he will lie with your wives in the sight of this son. In fact, on this same roof where you first saw Bathsheba. Taking the wives of a conquered king was a customary symbol of victory, all the more, how much the more, when it's a son taking his own father's women. And Ahithophel explains why. It's disgusting, but in this culture, here's why. It will strengthen the men, it will strengthen your standing with your men. I mean, think about it. In the early stages of the coup, probably the average Israelite waited on the fence to see who's going to win this thing? Where should I place my loyalty? And hopefully these guys will work out this inner family spat and they'll just figure it out among themselves. At this point, everybody knows there's no working this out. These guys are never going to be friends. I've got to choose a side. That's why Ahithophel says, go do this. It'll force people to side with you because you're obviously the one in charge here. He makes a second recommendation. Chapter 17, verse 1. Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, let me choose 12,000 men. I'll arise and pursue David tonight. I'll come on him while he's weary and discouraged and throw him into panic, and the people with him will flee. I'll strike down only the king and bring all the people back to you as a bride comes home to her husband. You seek the life of only one man, and all the people will be at peace. And the advice seemed right in the eyes of Absalom and all the elders of Israel. This is a good word. Strike fast, strike hard, it'll be easy, I'll do it myself. 12,000 men, that's all I need. Don't miss the fact that all the elders of Israel are supporting Absalom in this moment, and Ahithophel's advice is dead on the money. David has no chance if he does this. You know the condition he's in. You've been reading. He's got allies with him, but they're all in disarray. He's weeping, and Hushai knows and steps into that moment as God's exact man made to order. Look at verse 5. For whatever reason, Absalom says, call Hushai the Archite also and let us hear what he has to say. Oh, well, it's not whatever reason. We know what reason, right? We'll see it in a minute. It's right in the text. Verse 14. Verse 6. When Hushai, we'll see it in verse 14, but let's read verse 6. When Hushai came to Absalom, Absalom said, thus has Ahithophel spoken. Shall we do as he says? If not, you speak. And Hushai said to Absalom, in Hebrew, the first two words here are not good. Not good this time, Ahithophel's advice. Verse 8, you know your father and his men are mighty men. They're enraged like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. Besides, your father is expert in war. He won't spend the night with the people. Behold, even now he's hidden himself in one of the pits or some other place, and as soon as some of the people fall at the first attack, whoever hears it will say, there's been a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom, and then even the valiant man whose heart is like the heart of a lion will utterly melt with fear, for all Israel knows your father is a mighty man. Those with him are valiant men. So my counsel is that all Israel be gathered to you from Dan to Beersheba as the sand by the sea for multitude, and you go to battle in person. So we shall come upon him in some place where he is to be found, and we shall light on him as the dew falls on the ground, and of him and all the men with him, not one will be left. If he withdraws into a city, all Israel will bring ropes and drag it into the valley, and not a pebble to be found there. And Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. For the Lord had ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel so that the Lord might bring harm on Absalom. Notice the contrast. Ahithophel plans a surgical strike on a small scale and take out one guy. That'll easily unite the kingdom. Hushai appeals to Absalom's vanity. And he reminds Absalom and all the men with him of David's past legacy. He talks about bears and lions and what a mighty warrior he is and how savvy he is in battle, and he's probably hidden in a cave. And then he brings up Absalom's vanity. You need to get an army as big as the sand of the seashore from the north to the south. Gather everybody and don't let Ahithophel go out in charge. You go out in charge. And if there's anybody left, we'll kill them all. What is he doing? He's appealing to this guy's vanity. You be in charge. His bloodlust. We'll kill them all. His destructiveness. We'll pull down a city that houses him. That's wise advice, isn't it? If you're trying to counter someone else, you need to know your audience, and that's what Hushai's doing. He has no idea what Absalom's going to decide, though, so he warns David, verse 15. Hushai said to Zadok and Abiathar the priests, thus and so did Ahithophel counsel Absalom and the elders of Israel, and thus and so have I counseled. Therefore, send quickly and tell David, don't stay tonight at the fords of the wilderness. By all means, pass over, lest the king and all the people with him be swallowed up. So Jonathan and Ahimeaz were waiting at En-Rogel. A female servant was to go and tell them, and they were to go tell David, for they were not to be seen entering the city. But a young man saw them and told Absalom. So both of them went away quickly and came to the house of a man at Baharim who had a well in his courtyard, and they went down into it. And the woman took and spread a covering over the well's mouth and scattered grain, and nothing was known of it. So when Absalom's servants came to the woman at the house, they said, where are Ahimeaz and Jonathan? And the woman said, well, they've gone over the brook of water. So when they saw it and couldn't find them, they returned to Jerusalem. And after they had gone, the men came up out of the well and went and told King David. They said to David, arise, go quickly over the water, for thus and so has Ahithophel counseled against you. So David arose and all the people with him, and they crossed the Jordan. By daybreak, not one was left who had not crossed the Jordan. It's a touchy moment in the scene, but the narrator includes it for a particular reason. Does that scene sound familiar to you, where two like hidden spies are hiding and this woman covers them in a house and it's right near the Jordan? Yeah, there are echoes of Rahab in this story. And then David and his group crosses the other way back over the Jordan. This sounds like a little bit of a reverse of Israel coming into the land. That's on purpose. I'll explain why in just a second. Meanwhile, things on the opposing side aren't going well, verse 23. When Ahithophel saw his counsel was not followed, he saddled his donkey, went off home to his city, set his house in order, and hanged himself. And he died and was buried in the tomb of his father. Ahithophel lives and dies in the exact same way. With insight, deliberate intent, thoughtfulness, and an analytical awareness of everything that's happening around him, he realizes that his advice was not followed and Absalom's administration is over. if not an actual effect, inevitably, it's over. Ahithophel's death here is a foreshadowing of how Absalom's cause is going to go. The last few paragraphs show staging for the battle. Verses 24 to 6, Absalom is there at the river ready to fight. He presses a man into duty to be his general. Verses 27 to 9, David finds spontaneous support from all these people on the other side of the Jordan River. He's got everything he needs to be well prepared for battle. What's the point of all this? Well, I said it at the beginning, but let me say it again here. God is still in control, even when his kingdom is under attack, so trust him. Notice God's sovereignty all through this story, but it's working out silently, isn't it? The narrator tells us, David doesn't read this, but the narrator tells us in verse 14, the Lord had ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel so the Lord might bring harm on Absalom. God is still in control even when his kingdom is under attack, so trust him. That's what David does all through this story. He just radically trusts him, surrenders himself, yields to God, whatever God wants. I'm a sinner. I hope he'll deal with me in mercy. I would love to see the ark again. Hopefully I'll get back to Jerusalem, but I'm not going to try to manipulate him. Whatever he does for me, I will receive. Why? Three reasons. These are the applications. Because many of his friends still trust Yahweh. Right? That's the point the narrator wants to bring home to the readers. David's trust in God is being bolstered and encouraged by all of these people. Notice everyone in this story has to choose sides, either for David or Absalom. And if you choose Absalom, it's not just a bad choice, it's treason. That's still true. Friends, if you trust your oncologist more than Jesus, I understand, humanly speaking, but as a Christian, that's not just a bad choice. That could border on treason. You're wanting some human man or woman to bring healing into your life when you have the healer himself as your savior? So find encouragement in all of these people around you. That's the application here. David finds encouragement in his soldiers who still trust, and Hushai who still trusts, and these others who come to support him. David looks at all of these other people and sees he's not alone. Every one of these people is declaring for the right king, or like Ahithophel, declaring for the wrong king and going down. There's a second reason that David still trusts, and it's that he knows God has brought his people through this journey before. All those little geographical references, I unpacked it for you when I said, this is a reverse of the Exodus. This is a reverse of the group with Joshua coming to the promised land. David leaves Jerusalem and he crosses the Kidron Valley and he goes up the Mount of Olives and he crosses ultimately the Jordan River and he's leaving the promised land. But all of that is an echo that this narrator is giving us of Israel's first journey into the promised land. And if God brought him through the last time, he can bring him back this time. That's the point. David continues to trust God as he thinks about those stories. That's what the narrator wants us to be thinking about Rahab and Ruth and all of these people who declared loyalty to God and he took care of them. He's done it before. He's casting our eyes back, but he's also casting our eyes forward, isn't he? He's not just looking to the past, he's foreshadowing the future. That same journey was made by Israel's same king, well, not same king, but David's greater son, Israel's king, 1,000 years after David, wasn't it? Leaving Jerusalem, rejected by his own people, crossing the Kidron Valley, weeping the Mount of Olives. We know it as the Garden of Gethsemane, but that little enclave on the Mount of Olives. What's happening? David is only a shadow of Jesus on his way to the cross, his kingdom declared, but by all appearances crumbling all around him. David suffering for his own sins. Jesus suffering for no sins of his own, but David's sins and the sins of all his people and my sins and your sins. Friends, this is why we trust him. Because he would do that for us. Because in David's exile, we see Jesus's exile. And in David's protection of his people, we see Jesus dying for us, his people. Amen? Father, I pray that you would give us a faith in you that is even greater than David's. Help us see in this story the example of our King who trusts you. Help us receive the support of friends who trust you. Help us remember your great works in the past and trust you. And help us see Jesus and continue to trust you.